The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
The process of buying and selling a business can be frightening for the parties involved. What paperwork is needed? What is the true market value of the business? How do you know what transactions are required to be processed in addition to the sale of the business? Welcome to Biz Broker Talk, where you'll find the answers to these questions and much more. Your hosts, Robert Howells and Doug Scheiding, have a decade of experience providing business broker services to large and small businesses. Today, they're ready to help you. Here's Robert and Doug.
Welcome to Biz Broker Talk with Robert Howells and
Doug Scheiding.
We're owners of Business Brokers of San Antonio and Equipment Appraisers of San Antonio. Today is a pre-recorded show for New Year's Eve. If you wish to send an email request, you can send those to podcast@bizbrokertalk.com. That's podcast@bizbrokertalk.com, or visit us at bizbrokertalk.com. Today's show, we're going to be reviewing general items for buying a business. That includes, yes, your general items, but mainly defining your criteria, preparing for a purchase. We're going to discuss lending. We're also going to review how to go about finding a business and also dealing with brokers. So let me begin by just reviewing the some of the general items that a buyer is going to want to think about. Mainly, this is a lifestyle change. Lifestyle change is paramount to the transaction. Most buyers are buying themselves a job, and statistically, the buyers of a privately held business are first-time buyers and they're corporate refugees, somebody that's been downsized, right-sized, or newly retired. And we also know statistically that half the time a buyer purchases another business than what they originally came in on.
Yeah, they may, you know, come in on a dry cleaner and wind up purchasing a print shop.
That happens more than you can imagine, but certainly industry statistics tell us it's half the time, and our office, our own office, has shown that that's the case. We also need to understand that it takes time and a lot of effort to purchase a business. It's a lot of research, and there's no, although it can happen quickly, most deals take about 4 to 6 months, and that's after you've found the business.
And actually, with larger businesses, that time for purchase actually increases. Somewhat due to the longer due diligence and more items to review, but generally, a larger business is going to take longer from a time standpoint.
But being able to identify the business you want to buy is going to take effort. It's not something that is simply done unless you already have experience in the industry. Most people are buying a business that's different than what they've been historically in their corporate life.
And so I think that's important from the standpoint of if you are looking at a change, you need to kind of see out in the future as compared to thinking you're going to buy a business and 2 months later start having income from that business, because the whole process takes longer than that.
That's true. 90% of the time, it's a first-time buyer. I think it might even be a little bit higher than that in our own office, but generally speaking, industry statistics show us that someone purchasing a privately held business, it's 90% of the time it's the first time that they've purchased a business, and almost half of our buyers are from outside of our geography. Doug, you read a study recently about the geography of buyers.
Yeah, actually, on both of those, it's a Pepperdine study, and 92% of buyers of businesses less than $500,000, according to the study that just came out, show that that's they're a first-time buyer. For businesses in the $500,000 to $1 million range, it's more like about 87%, but that's where the 90% figure comes from. And in terms of buyers outside the geography, I think we're about 40%. Last year and this year. Luckily, our region is an attractive region. But overall, buyers are, I think it's what, less than 20 miles away for businesses less than 500,000. It's a 55% come from less than 20 miles away. So 45% are more than 20 miles away. So it's outside their normal geography of where they particularly live.
Yeah, so most buyers that we see are corporate refugees. So their spouse has been relocated, or they've had early retirement or been downsized. They're moving home to take care of their parents. They're looking to purchase themselves a job in an area different than where they had lived or worked before. And there's also some general items you need to know, such as individuals buying a business versus a corporate purchase. Individuals do look at it as if they're buying a job. They're looking at it from their position of what they need to take home after servicing the debt of acquiring the business and paying taxes and having some money left over, which the banks like to call a coverage ratio. So corporate purchases are a different world for the most part. Some of them are purchasing market share. Some are a strategic purchase, and some are a synergistic purchase. You want to review some of those?
Well, in terms of, you know, synergistic, maybe it's a like type business. Maybe you've got a carpet cleaning business and you want to add a janitorial. So it's another like and kind service that can kind of fit into the puzzle piece. Another type of corporate buyer, it might be, you know, an expansion. They might be located in one state, say Chicago, and want to buy another location of a like type business in a different area. So that would be another type of corporate buyer.
A strategic one, maybe. So there's also something that we get a lot of calls on. People are looking for a passively owned business.
Drives me crazy.
How many times do you get a call that says, yeah, I want to keep my current job, but I want to purchase and run a business and just reap the rewards of it? It's, you know, you really need to work in the business for four seasons to understand the nuances of the business, the personalities that are involved, the vendors, the customer base, the systems that are in place. Because if your key employee leaves, you've got no backup.
Yeah, it's also called an absentee type business. And in my mind, there is no such thing as an absentee type business. You, as the owner, are the backup for employees, managers, et cetera, if someone doesn't show up. So, in fact, one of our last closings was exactly that. A gentleman that bought a restaurant thought it was going to be an absentee type situation. And unfortunately, he was involved with the business a lot more than he cared to. So if you've got this idea that this is going to be the panacea to your financial problems or additional income, don't count on it, an absentee or a passively owned type
anyone business. That passively owns a business, isn't working in there, say, more than 10 hours a week, is somebody that's been in that business more than 3 years. They didn't just purchase the business and start running it passively. They worked in the business. They understand the systems, the processes, and all the things we spoke about earlier. And they can sell that business to somebody, but that person that buys that is going to need to be actively involved in that business for at least a year and possibly more before they're going to be able to become a passive in the business.
Exactly. When you want to buy a business, grow it to the point that you can go off to hunting and be gone a lot of the week, but that's after being in the business for 3 to 5 years.
And one of the two vertical markets or two industries we see the most of those requests on are storage units and RV.
And those, to me, those are more real estate type plays and not a business transaction. And we certainly don't see them come on the market ever, if at all.
Yeah, I mean, there are RV parks and there are storage units and car washes, for that matter.
Oh yeah, car
that
washes
kick off enough revenue that it is a business transaction. But more than not, the strategy that the owner took was to have either an RV park or a storage facility or a car wash there until such time as the real estate has appreciated, they can sell the real estate. And most of these businesses don't cash flow enough to support a passive owner unless they're already retired with a second source of income. Most of these businesses are an owner-operator, certainly 30 hours or 40 hours more a week. As car washes break down, they get vandalized, trash needs to get empty. There is a lot of work that goes on in car washes and storage units as well. So those are more real estate plays that we've seen. And you really have to know what you want. My suggestion is to put pen to paper and sit down and understand what it is you want and what you don't want and how much you want to invest and what you want out of it. But you really need to have a very good outline about what it is you want before you go and begin searching for a business.
The good news from a buying perspective is that for businesses, let's say less than $1 million in purchase price, that same Pepperdine Market Pulse study showed that over 60% of brokers thought it was more of a buyer's market for smaller type businesses. And that's somewhat due to the retirement and the baby boomers, which, as we'll go into, but our next guest for next show, we'll speak about some.
Right. And so we need to define the criteria of what a buyer would want to start outlining. So one of them is lifestyle. Lifestyle is key to understanding what it is you want. You know, are you wanting to work weekends? Do you want to work evenings, such as a lot of retail? So you need to define what kind of a lifestyle you want to lead in after the purchase of the business.
Or not travel as much. Some buyers want, you know, they're on the road, they're salespeople, they're gone 3 to 4 days a week, their kids are getting older, and they want to start being there at their, you know, football practice and soccer practices and things like that.
And that's key. So your lifestyle is key, and that needs to be maybe the high point, the number one point in your criteria for your search. Industry focus versus skill focus. You know, is it an industry you're wanting in, or is a certain skill that you have that you want to, such as management skill or financial analysis skill or sales skill, that you're looking for a business that suits your skill versus an industry that you're interested in?
I think from the standpoint of buying a business, if you are more of a skills type focus, it's going to take a lot longer, maybe an order of magnitude longer, because if you think you're a turnaround specialist, or you've got these, you know, you hear that, and, you know, sales specialist, et cetera, that can apply to a lot of different industries. Well, you're going to have to narrow your focus to at least what you don't want, or what industries that you are interested in.
And so, more importantly, in my eyes, dealing with buyers is understanding what you don't want to work in. I don't want to do retail. I don't want to do food service. I don't want to work evenings. I don't want to work weekends. Knowing what you don't want is, to me, better to be able to define and to narrow down and parse out what it is that would be a potential business. And income needs are important as well. You want to understand what your take home is after taxes.
Yeah, I think, you know, from the standpoint of if you're looking to make $100,000, well, is that $100,000 after taxes, or is that $100,000 before taxes? So I think that's a critical point to understand, because that you'll have to narrow your search down to certain businesses that cash flow, or that has this certain seller's discretionary earnings, like we talked about last show.
In understanding what the historic revenues and cash flow of the business is versus the future. So if an owner has owned the business 20 years and they don't have any debt, they're not servicing any debt, no loans, and they may have already paid off the real estate, for example, the only thing they're paying is taxes and insurance, that historic is not going to look anything like the future cash flow. You're going to have a note for acquiring it, most likely. You're going to have your taxes and insurance. You're going to have enough money to live your life, and you're going to have money to reinvest in the business. And that is going to be much different than what the historical cash flow looked like. And lenders are going to want to look at tax returns and your income needs. And so these are documents that, you know, just like purchasing a home, you need to pull together your last three years' tax returns and what expenses you have, your mortgage payments, your any debt service that you have on automobile purchases, student loans, whatever the case may be.
I mean, we'll talk about it more in the lending section of tonight's show, but the lender is going to look at your historic tax returns from the standpoint of what you've been accustomed to making, not necessarily what your minimum expenses are. So if you've been making $100,000, but your expenses are only $50,000, they're going to put in $100,000 as your income requirement, not your $50,000, which is what you really need to cover your basic.
That certainly is one approach. That's one of the approaches that the lenders take. You also need to identify what other sources of income you have. Do you have rental homes? Do you have getting paid on retirement?
Spouse working. You've got rental homes, et cetera. Now, in terms of if you're buying a business and defining your criteria, are you going to purchase an independent type business, or are you going to look at franchises? Those are two very different worlds. The franchise is being in business, but you're not being in business by yourself. You've got the franchisor support. They've got an established model, training that they provide, support that's provided. Usually they'll have regional people, et cetera. So if you're interested in a franchise, typically you'll go through what's called a franchise consultant. There's several different large chains out there, that FranNet and FranChoice and other types of organizations, or you can find a local independent consultant. And basically what that consultant will do is, with a franchise, it's all about net worth and it's about liquidity. And those are the first two hurdles to get through for the franchise. If you don't have a net worth of $500,000, basically your net worth of $500,000 and liquidity of a couple hundred thousand, they won't even talk to you. It's not worth the time. A franchise consultant will work with you based on what net worth and what liquidity you have and what interests and lifestyle you're interested in, and they'll propose usually three at a time, three different concepts
that are available
in your area. Yeah. That's a good point, because some areas are already built out, and depending on the franchise.
Some aren't available. Some may want a Dunkin' Donuts, for example, and Dunkin' Donuts isn't expanding your area, or they may have no more available.
Or they might not even be offering that franchise in the area, because as with the franchise, they typically have to register with the state in order to offer that opportunity. So if you're interested in a franchise, that would be something that you should work with a franchise consultant. And what's very important is what's called an item 19, which is the financial profitability forecast that they provide. And that's in the FDD or the document that describes the full franchise. But I think we're coming up against a break.
Yeah, and so when we come back, we're going to continue with defining your criteria, discussing geography and liquidity, and I look forward to speaking to you shortly.
Get the news on our shows and other happenings by following us on Twitter. Find us at VoiceAmericaTRN or twitter.com/VoiceAmericaTRN.
Business brokerage is a very regional business due to the requirement of having face-to-face buyer and seller meetings. While Robert and Doug are regionally centric to South Central Texas with their brokerage company, Business Brokers of San Antonio, and their equipment appraisal company, Equipment Appraisers of San Antonio, they have also established BizBrokerTalk.com to help assist sellers and buyers with finding professionals in a variety of areas required in the business transaction process. This includes certified business brokers, SBA loan packagers, 401k conversion companies, lenders, as well as other necessary advisory sources. Whether you're selling or buying a business, you need a team of professionals on your side to guide you through the process. Visit BizBrokerTalk.com today. And if you're in the South Texas area, please visit Business Brokers of San Antonio at bbofsa.com or Equipment Appraisers of San Antonio at eaofsa.com.
Now you don't have to stay linked to your desktop or laptop. Take Voice America on the go and listen anywhere. Get our mobile app for iPhone, BlackBerry, or Android at the Apple iTunes App Store, BlackBerry App World, or Android Market.
This is Biz Broker Talk with Robert Howells and Doug Scheiding. To reach the show today, please call 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. Or you may send an email to podcast@bizbrokertalk.com. Now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Biz Broker Talk with Robert Howells.
And Doug.
And we are talking about defining your criteria in the search of a business, buying a business in today's marketplace. So let's talk about geography. Are you willing to move? Some people, as we discussed earlier, corporate refugees, they've been downsized, right-sized, or newly retired, and they're relocating to where their spouse is getting a job or to be with their family, or they've just gotten out of the military. So are you willing to move from where you currently are? That's a primary issue.
Well, but it also could be related to your lifestyle as well. If you've got aging parents or you want to get out of the cold weather of the north and you want to be closer to family, et cetera. So that also can lead into lifestyle type questions.
And one of the issues we run into is if you're relocating and you're not sure about the new city. You know, I know I'm going to move to Arizona or I'm going to move to California, but I'm not really sure where I want to live in that, and that's where speaking with a broker and understanding what the economy is like and what opportunities are available and how the lending standards are different in all sorts of geographies, state within the state. I mean, there's all sorts of things that can affect your purchase of a business. So if you're not relocating and you know you're going to relocate, but you're just not sure where you're going to relocate to, that's something that needs to be worked out, obviously. And is the business that you're looking at purchasing, is it relocatable? There are some businesses, we sold a business that did construction contracting that was an internet business, and it could virtually have been located anywhere.
Exactly. I've got an internet business right now that can be located virtually anywhere within the state, but it could be located, but and sometimes it can be relocated within in the town. For example, if you've got like a home healthcare staffing type business where you don't have customers coming to your facility, that could be relocated as well, or within a city,
or a business which the lease is ending and you're going to have to relocate it. That can sometimes become an issue. And you know, it can you commute? You know, is this something where we had somebody that lived out in the country and wanted a business within 3 miles of their house or something?
Yes. 3 miles. They're 3 to 5 miles of their house.
Lived out in the country. There wasn't enough businesses in the area that were privately held to satisfy his needs. But you know, it's what kind of a commute are you comfortable with? So geography, after the financial aspect of it, is understanding what geographically where the business is located and where the customer base is probably going to be important to you.
And you need to make sure your spouse is. One of my personal stories is I told my wife we were going to move to Houston, and she said she was going to quit her job, and I said, "Well, stay right here, and I'll commute to Houston every week." So make sure your spouse is involved in that that decision as well.
So the liquidity. What your capital liquidity is, you know, you really need to understand what your true cash injection into the transaction. Now, it's not what you have in cash today. It may be your 401k you're rolling over to fund the deal, which we're going to have a show on that in a couple weeks. It's not necessarily the cash in the bank. It could be some stocks you're liquidating. It could be retirement funds forthcoming. It can come from a sale of property.
Home equity line of credit. So, yeah, there's liquidity and then there's semi-liquid.
Yep.
So stocks are semi-liquid because you have to sell those. That's, you know, it's not something. So if you're buying a business, don't think you're going to sell your stocks today and automatically have $50,000 in the bank tomorrow.
Yeah, you're
there's a clearing time.
Yeah, there's 2 to 3 months. Typically, even on lending, once you've put a deal in place, but before you put the deal in place, you understand what assets you have that can be liquidated or willing to liquidate. and what kind of time frame that's going to take. Even rolling over 401k can sometimes take several weeks.
Exactly. And as we found out just recently as well, the new banking requirements, when you open a new account, they will put a hold. So even if you think you have liquid money and you have $50,000 to put in, they may put a, and you're transferring that from another institution, they may put a hold on that.
Large sums, large new account and large sums being transferred in. There's a waiting period. I think that's a Patriot Act issue that comes up. And you have to understand, you know, that each one of these financial tools that are out there, each of these facilities has their own criteria about how they get liquidated, what the tax implications are associated with that. You need to go through some discovery with your tax advisor on what you're going to be hit with tax-wise, state and federal taxes on liquidating some of these assets to know what you're really going to net, which you don't want is a big tax bill after purchasing a business from your liquidating of assets.
Oh, yeah, exactly. Well, yeah.
And it's happened. And you ought to have a feel for what your risk tolerance is. You know, how much money you can inject in the deal, how much you need to hold for your own working capital, and how much, you know, both personally to run your life and the business. So your risk tolerance is going to have to be defined, and that's a lot of issues that deal with understanding your risk tolerance, but mainly it's a financial risk tolerance we're talking about today.
Exactly. I mean, if you've got $500,000 liquid, but you're willing to invest $200,000 or $250,000, then you've got the other $250,000 as a cushion. So you need to understand how much you're willing to invest in the business as a down payment. And you certainly don't want to be undercapitalized or not have enough working capital to invest in the business once you do purchase it, because that is one of the major items on why a business does fail.
And don't be undercapitalized, as Doug says. I mean, we tell people the minimum you need to have 90 days to run your life in the business, assuming that you're not going to make a penny out of it. I mean, that business may be kicking off $10,000 a year, $10,000 a month for the current owner, but you just need to just know that you need to have enough in hand to live your life, run your life and the business for at least 3 months, just in case. And in some instances, like when we purchased our business, this brokerage, it was a year. We made sure we had enough money to run the business and our lives for a year, and that almost didn't become enough money in the end of the day.
Yeah, exactly.
How long things take to get running and to get paid on, it takes a long time to settle out. And, you know, like Doug's brought up before, you need to make sure your spouse needs to be involved in the process and that they have an interest in the transaction.
Actually, yeah, when we're dealing with buyers and we have buyer-seller meetings, I'm always more comfortable with those buyers that bring their spouse to the first meeting, because then I know that, A, they are serious, and they're both making the decision on purchasing the business.
So let's summarize for a minute. You're going to need to sit down and define your life, your criteria. It begins with identifying what kind of lifestyle I'm going to lead, what industry or skill set you're trying to fulfill in the purchase. You want to look at what your income needs are, whether it's an individual independent business or it's a franchise. You want to look at what geography, and you need to look at what liquidity you have to get the deal done. Now let's talk about preparation. There's certain things you're going to need to prepare for lending.
As a buyer,
and you're going to need to just like, it's very similar to the process that you go through on a mortgage. And that is putting together a personal financial statement. And that's going to require you to get financial statements, you know, so maybe last couple of months, mortgage statements, bank statements. You have an overall summary of your balance sheet, what the assets you own.
Copies of your payroll amounts that you're getting now, but, you know, tax returns.
Yeah, previous years, 3 years tax returns maybe, and any other financial assets you have. And every lender is going to be a little bit different, but, you know, you should look at I think, you know, I think 3 years and year-to-date, your last year's tax return, year-to-date income state or payroll stub, and probably the last 2 or 3 months of your mortgage statements and any payments that you're making on homes or other properties.
Absolutely. And as we mentioned in last show to the seller, file your taxes on time. Don't get into the habit of filing the extensions, et cetera, because if you're trying to purchase a business, that's going to inhibit you from being able to go through the
the lending process, most likely.
So you want to have a list of what your financial holdings are.
Holdings and liabilities.
And liabilities. You know, here's a list of what I own. Here's the vehicles I own. Here's the properties I own. Any other types of interest you may have. And here's a list of the liabilities I have, and have supporting documentation for that. And this is not, you know, when you get to start talking about lending, you understand that this is not real estate. This is purchasing a business. You need to plan on having 20 to 30% liquidity of the purchase price. If you're buying a business that's sales price $1 million, you need to have, you know, $200,000, not an unreasonable sum to have available to purchase the business.
Absolutely. And on the preparation, probably the final thing as it relates to lending is know your credit score, because the minimum credit score you're going to have is what, 700 or so that you need in order to qualify for.
Yeah, 730.
Yes.
Yeah, low 700.
700, 720. So know your credit score, because that will be a factor in lending, because that's one of the first things that they're going to run.
Yeah, so if you think about the way that banks look at transactions, it's credit and character and collateral. Sellers look at, if the sellers are having to carry a note, they're looking at it, a different aspect. They're looking at character of the buyer. If they're going to carry any portion of a note, they want to know what kind of person you are and how you've handled your financials previously, but they're in bed with you for a period of time. And so, you know, what your character is, how you've historically run your life is going to be a main factor for the seller if they're carrying that note. But this is not real estate. Although real estate does help as a collateral for a transaction, we had a gentleman that had a lot of property holdings that helped his family purchase a business. And we've also had another buyer that wasn't able to get lending because all of their properties that they held were encumbered. That means that they had large loans against it and had other investors in the property of which they were minority shareholder in, and they weren't able to secure lending because even though they had assets, they were all encumbered and they were privately held, you know, minority shareholders in these. Anything you want to say on real estate?
Well, lending, if you're purchasing or looking at a business that does have real estate, there's two different programs. There's a 504 SBA program or a 7A, so it actually may affect what type of lending is available and how much you have to put down, depending on whether the real estate is involved. So now maybe we can talk a little bit about traditional or conventional type loans.
Oh, historically, generally speaking, because every lender is going to have a different scenario and a different, you know, historically what they've done. But generally speaking, collateral is king in lending. So if you're going out to borrow $100,000, they want to make sure that there's $100,000 securing that loan. So if you're buying a print shop, they want to make sure that the liquidation value of the assets in that print shop is $100,000 or maybe $110,000. To cover their cost of liquidating it. If you're going to go secure a loan and say it's a $500,000 transaction and there's $100,000 worth of assets in the business, and they may ask that you pledge the other $400,000 either in stocks or other securities or cash value of life policies. I mean, there's any numerous ways that you can collateralize the transaction, but historically, traditional lending is a collateralized transaction. They don't do cash flow lending.
Oh, yeah. They really like CDs for collateral, actually.
In their deposit in their account.
Exactly.
In their bank,
yeah.
That's for sure.
So CDs are always good.
Then there's some cash flow lenders out there, and the cash flow lenders are really looking at the historical cash flow of the business, that the business that's being acquired has contracts in place, and no one customer is more than 20% of the revenue of the business to reduce the risk tolerance of it, and your direct industry experience. You know, if you're going to work with a cash flow lender, you're going to have industry experience, and you're going to have to show that you have some collateral, but mainly that you have enough liquidity to pay the note if the business should have an upset in the marketplace, and that you can pay for your lifestyle outside of that business. And so cash flow lenders though there's some out there, they really look at someone has a second source of income with direct industry experience.
Yeah, the industry experience also can affect how much you have to put down from an investment standpoint. So if you're familiar with automotive, the industry, and you're all of a sudden going to open up a restaurant, so instead of 20% down, if you would have stayed in automotive, you might have to put 30% down because you're a little riskier from a bank's eyes. So that may affect how much you actually have to have from a liquidity standpoint.
Right. And then another type of lending is what people hear. We hear SBA lending. SBA is not a lender. SBA underwrites for banks, and there are two types or for lenders, and there's two types of lender, a certified and a preferred lender. You really want to be dealing with a preferred lender, somebody that can underwrite the deal in-house. And what the SBA does, they essentially underwrite up to 75% of the loan.
Yeah, they guarantee up to 75% of the loan, and it's a preferred or PLP, as they're often called. So if you're talking to your bank that you're used to dealing with, and that's going to be your first point of a contact for trying to get a loan for a business acquisition, ask them if they're a PLP. That should be your first question for them.
And when we return, we're going to finish up with discussions on lending and then discuss finding a business and dealing with brokers. Thank you for listening.
Now you don't have to stay linked to your desktop or laptop. Take Voice America on the go and listen anywhere. Get our mobile app for iPhone, BlackBerry, or Android at the Apple iTunes App Store, BlackBerry App World, or Android Market.
Business brokerage is a very regional business due to the requirement of having face-to-face buyer and seller meetings. While Robert and Doug are regionally centric to South Central Texas with their brokerage company, Business Brokers of San Antonio, and their equipment appraisal company, Equipment Appraisers of San Antonio, they have also established BizBrokerTalk.com to help assist sellers and buyers with finding professionals in a variety of areas required in the business transaction process. This includes certified business brokers, SBA loan packagers, 401k conversion companies, lenders, as well as other necessary advisory sources. Whether you're selling or buying a business, you need a team of professionals on your side to guide you through the process. Visit BizBrokerTalk.com today. And if you're in the South Texas area, please visit Business Brokers of San Antonio at bbofsa.com or Equipment Appraisers of San Antonio at eaofsa.com.
Save on your prescriptions with the RX Savings Plus Drug Discount Card offered by Voice America. It is not insurance, and discounts are only available from participating pharmacies. But 9 out of 10 pharmacies participate nationwide. Start saving today. Print your free card online at voiceamerica.rxsavingsplus.com or text the word TALK RADIO to 96362.
This is Biz Broker Talk with Robert Howells and Doug Scheiding. To reach the show today, please call 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. Or you may send an email to podcast@bizbrokertalk.com. Now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Biz Broker Talk with Robert Howells.
And Doug Scheiding.
We're speaking today about buying a business, and specifically we're discussing lending, and we're talking about SBA lending. Doug, what are your thoughts on currently the lending environment with Small Business Administration back loans?
Very conservative. You hear a lot of hype in the what I call hype in the news about all the loans that are being done through the SBA program, but I'd say by and large, most of those are through, as we mentioned earlier, the 504 program, which is real estate oriented.
Asset oriented, yeah. Asset intensive, not asset, necessarily business acquisitions.
Not a true BizAc or business acquisition type loan where you're buying a business that's located in a strip center and doesn't come with the real estate. It comes with the lease.
It doesn't have a lot of assets, and so it's what they refer to as a 7A loan. Now, the SBA will underwriter guarantee up to 75% of those loans, right?
Right, and that's why a lot of banks like to use the SBA program for business acquisition, because it's a lot more risky from a bank's perspective than a real estate, because they've got the collateral. And so they like the SBA guarantee of the 75%. So if the loan does go south, then they've got an avenue through the government program. But that doesn't come for free. Basically, the borrower pays for that in the guarantee fees that are associated with the origination of every SBA loan.
You know, it's the standard operating procedures that used to come out every quarter or so, now coming out so frequently, it's hard to keep up with it, which is why you need to work with a lender that has someone that just does SBA lending. But, you know, that can be 2 or 3% of the loan could be the guarantee fee. And that can be a significant $10,000, $20,000, $30,000 guarantee fee that's paid up front, or typically they'll roll it into the note, but you're now going to pay interest on that guarantee fee for the life of that loan. And that loan can be 7 to 10 years.
Exactly. And then also there's with the SOP, or the standard operating procedures document for the SBA guidelines, there's also requirements for valuations. So you're going to have to spend more money typically on doing a business valuations, depending on the amount of goodwill, equipment appraisal type valuations, et cetera. So that those requirements are also built in.
I think that I think it was 2010, maybe maybe before that, I think it was 2008, where they came and did an audit and they found out that some lenders were having two different criteria, one for SBA-backed loans and one for their internal conventional loans. And they came in and said there can only be one standard. And so that's why getting an SBA-backed loan from one bank isn't the same as getting it from another. And we always encourage buyers to put in at least three applications, not talk to three banks, put in three applications, because you're going to get three different answers.
And
I've never seen any two bank offers the same.
They're going to look at it differently, and it's going to be an inch of material that you're going to have to fill out, and it's going to be painful and time-consuming,
but
it has to be done.
Yeah, you need to put in at least three applications to find out, because each bank is going to look at their underwriting procedures with their SBA-backed loan that's going to be looked at differently. There's also other sources that need to be looked at for financing.
A lender or a bank really likes it if you've got an alternate source of income, so that you're not,
spouse
especially.
Rental properties.
So that you're not solely relying on the business that you're purchasing for 100% of your income.
There's other forms of financing, such as 401k. That's how we purchased this, is we rolled over our 401ks to fund the acquisition of this, and the money that we didn't use to acquire our brokerage, we invested back in the market in a self-directed plan. So there's a number of firms out there that do that. We will be having one of those firms will be on with us in a couple of weeks. And also, ultimately, what buyers probably are used to seeing is seller financing.
I love the call that you get from a buyer and that says that they're looking for a business and they're willing to work hard, but they want the seller to finance 90% of it. Or maybe larger. So
I don't know if I'd want a business with a seller so desperate they'd finance 90%.
Exactly. If it's not the business you're currently working in, you're probably not going to find it.
True. Or a very desperate seller.
Exactly. Or a very desperate seller.
Overpriced business or a desperate seller. But you're looking for most sellers are willing to carry 10 to 30% in a note. They don't want to be deleveraging the transaction. So if a buyer, let's talk about a general lending scenario. Generally speaking, a lender will lend up to 70% of the transaction. You'll typically get a lender to lend between 50 and 70% of the transaction. The other 30% of that 70 that's being financed by the bank, the other 30% is either buyer down payment or seller carrying a note. And so a standard, you know, structure that you may see is buyer injects 10%. The lender finances 70% and the seller will finance the rest.
Like in your example, that'd be 20%.
Mm-hmm.
If they're going through the SBA, that's unattractive from a seller standpoint. And as a buyer, you need to understand this, because the lender and or SBA are going to require the seller to take a standby note. Standby at what? 1 year,
2 years.
1 to 2 years?
Two years, which means that the seller can't get paid, certainly on principle, but in theory, they can't get paid on that seller note for 2 years. So let's say that you purchase a business and I'm the seller, and the lender says that because of the lack of collateral of the buyer and the lack of assets of the business, I, the seller, am required to carry a note of 10%, and it's a $1 million transaction. I'm now carrying a note for $100,000, which I can't get paid on for 2 years. And the reasoning behind that is that they want to make sure that you, the buyer, are able to run the business before you start paying the secondary note.
Right.
So the problem is, from a buyer or seller standpoint, is A, I'm in second position in this deal to the bank. If things go south, the business gets liquidated, the bank gets paid off, and I'm second in line getting paid off. Second thing is, I don't get paid on my note. We've been able to get, for some of our sellers, be able to negotiate so that the seller is able to negotiate interest only,
or with approval from the bank, depending on the cash flow of the business. After 6 months or so, the bank can approve that note be paid off.
But that
has to be done with approval.
Yeah, it's very difficult. So understand that. But seller financing is generally 10 to 30% is what we see in small business transactions, you know, deals under $5 million. The seller's usually willing to carry 10% if the lender's requiring it, or if the buyer wants to make sure that the seller abides by their non-compete and their training and transition. It's a risk issue from somebody's perspective is why the seller's carrying a note, but it's generally that the buyer doesn't have industry experience, there's not have enough collateral to pull it off, or they want to make sure the seller abides by a training and transition and non-compete.
Right. So as a buyer, you need to take that into perspective when you're when you're providing an offer to a seller, that if there's going to be lending involved, they're probably going to require some sort of seller note. Now, on the other hand, if I am a buyer, I would like a seller to take some in a note. So take that into consideration when you have your buyer-seller meeting. You're interviewing them from a selling of a business standpoint, but they're also interviewing you from a buyer standpoint. Do they have the confidence in you that once you take over the business, you're not going to run it into the ground?
Yeah. And capital. You know, you need to have some working capital, whether you're borrowing it or you're using your own money. The deal going right now where the buyer's having to demonstrate they have their own working capital for the deal. Either you can have your own cash to have the working capital, or you're going to secure it somehow, property or CD or something. But working capital initially on purchasing a business where you don't have direct industry experience is sometimes a challenge.
You got to find the business, Bob.
You got to find it. Finding that business, there are several websites. We advertise to about 15
different websites,
but things like BizQuest, BizBuySell, Businesses for Sale, Merger Network,
and BusinessBroker.net.
So. BusinessBroker.net, and also Craigslist. I mean, there's all sorts of places that list, but Craigslist is...
If you're looking for a business on Craigslist, hopefully it's not going to be a primary source of income, or it's going to be more of a passion or hobby.
But there's a large difference we see in the marketplace between a for sale by owner and by a broker represented in the market transaction. So let's go back and think about what we talked about the first show is majority of businesses transfer without a broker involved, and most of those transferred either that heir apparent, somebody that's in the company or as a family member, and secondarily it gets transferred to another like business in the geography. So majority of the business transactions statistically go that way. Those that are being sold outside of the heir apparent or to a
middle management
or competitor in the marketplace or junior, it's going to go through either a broker or the seller is going to try to sell themselves on the market. And we see those deals after the deal hasn't worked. And that's how we know that broker deals have more success in getting done than if a seller tries to sell on their own.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, because if we have a seller from a listing, as we talked about last show, we only want motivated sellers.
Yep.
And the motivation, you know, it can be a variety of different reasons. For sale by owner or FISBO, as it's sometimes called, they may be just testing the market. They might be just wanting to see, you know, what other people are willing to pay for it. And a lot of times you'll talk to buyers and they'll tell you a horror story about how their business that they were going to buy fell through because the seller backed out at the last minute.
That's probably the number one thing we hear from buyers. They tried to do a deal before and the seller backed out at or before close.
They became, all of a sudden they fell back in love with the business.
back in love with the business, or then they realized their tax implications on the price that they had set, and they didn't go check their tax implications before closing.
Yeah, exactly.
And the other thing about going through a broker business is confidentiality protects both parties. I think that, you know, if you're going to buy a business, it's better that you know that it's been handled by a broker that has confidentiality agreements in place. So when you buy that business, you probably aren't the first person to see that business to know that the employees and customers and vendors don't know it's for sale, and that you're able to navigate the disclosure of that on your own.
That kind of brings into working with a broker. When you inquire on a business, and we mentioned some of the websites, you're going to have to provide some sort of financial information. Typically, we're not going to ask for bank statements or proof of verification.
Or account numbers or account names, just a summary balance sheet.
How much do you have? How much are you willing to invest? What's your risk tolerance? What do you have liquid? What do you have semi-liquid? Depending on the sophistication of the buyer, we may have to kind of help them in terms of, okay, you can, you know, invest up to $200,000, but if you're inquiring on a business that's $3 million in purchase price, you don't have enough assets.
So you need to be able to provide a summary of your summary balance sheet, let's say. You also need to be prepared to sign a confidentiality agreement that you're not going to disclose the sale to anybody but your financial advisor and maybe an attorney, and an acknowledgement of the services of the broker handling it. And you have to understand that the broker is not working against the buyer. Although the broker may want may push back to the buyer because they want to make sure that you are motivated. So if you don't get an immediate return phone call or you don't get immediate response, some of the old school brokerage, it's because they want to make sure the buyer is motivated. They're not just clicking on sites at night because they got nothing else to do. It's really that they want to make sure they're dealing with a motivated buyer. So be prepared to fill out the documents and potentially follow up. But the broker is invested in the transaction. They don't get paid until the deal gets done. They have a vested interest in this. And so the broker works for the seller typically. But they
represents the seller. They represent the responsibility to the seller.
But they don't work against the buyer. They'll help you find financing if you need advisors. Typically, they'll help you source that.
Listen to the broker because they've closed many transactions, and they have experience in doing different types of deals. So while you can listen to their advice, you probably should take the information and listen to what they're saying.
And never give your escrow money to the broker. There should be an escrow account open through a third party, an attorney or an escrow company, where these monies go.
If there is a broker and he's saying that he will hold the escrow money in his account, you should run the other way.
Well, you should find some other means of someone handling that escrow. And, you know, brokers aren't totally necessary. It's not like real estate. There's not a whole lot of co-brokering going on out there. But they are an advisor, and they are a trusted advisor, which you should rely on. That's pretty much it we have for this show. Next week, we'll be having John Denny. He's an exit planner, a business coach, a facilitator, and a business consultant. He's written several books. His latest is Hunting in a Farmer's World, about the differences that drive entrepreneurs. Part of that, he did a book on beating the boomer bust, which we'll have another show on, and also 11 things you absolutely need to know about selling your business. That's John Denny next week on Tuesday, 4 o'clock Pacific time. Thank you.
Thank you again for joining us today for Biz Broker Talk. Please join Robert and Doug again next Tuesday at 4 p.m. Pacific Time, 7 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Business Channel. After today's show, we hope you are one step closer to a successful sale of your business. The information and ideas provided within this show are intended for educational purposes only and not intended as investment advice. The hosts of this show do not provide tax or legal advice. You should consult with your tax or legal professional regarding your individual situation. No information should be interpreted as securities advice. With regard to your particular investments and financial strategies, consult your financial planner, CPA, and investment professionals. While we have endeavored to ensure the accuracy of the information in this program, we do not guarantee or give any warranty as to the accuracy, timeliness, or completeness of any information.
Thanks again for listening to the preceding program brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check out additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the preceding program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.